Hey everybody, welcome back. It's goodlifebabe.com. Jeff and Joel's Tales from New Orleans.
All right, folks, we're back. Jeff and Joel's Tales from New Orleans. It's a goodlifebabe.com. We got some guests here with us today.
We promised guests, Jeff. We promised them.
We promised guests.
We're delivering.
We let everybody know our 251 likes that we have on Facebook that we were going to have guests today. So, guys, this is some high-stakes business that we're doing here, long-format podcasting.
You told us before we went on that it was 250, and now you said 251.
I just assumed.
Time just changed.
It just went up during that five-minute span.
Checked one it since we had that conversation just now.
Folks, we have this is our literary podcast, and we have a couple of writers here with us. They're both big-time New Orleans writers. Is that an accurate description?
Is that on your Wikipedia page, big time?
Yeah,
big time.
That means
I don't have a Wikipedia page. You?
No, I
LinkedIn.
Don't. And you don't? I mean, do people make those for themselves? I always thought that was like something you waited around for someone else to do for you.
So look, a fan of
for, I'm gonna
right,
get back
exactly.
to that in one second, but yeah. Finish with the intros. We got Gwendolyn Knapp here.
Hello.
And Michael Patrick Welch.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could say what you're freelance writers, I would say for the most part, right? And also
Gwendolyn has a real job, actually.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
I suppose, yeah.
And what is it?
Well, I edit Eater Nola, and then I am a part-time author.
I love Eater Nola.
Do you?
Well, the happy hour thing was the summer happy hour thing.
Oh, yeah.
I love that this year.
Yeah.
Because I sought them all out.
Awesome.
I looked at them.
Yeah,
there's
so
map,
many. This is like
and you can
happy
just,
hour town.
It's so easy to see where they're, you know, how you want to spend your afternoon.
Yes.
I love it.
Dude, I just want to say, getting back to the Wikipedia thing, that's a thing.
Yeah.
And for bands now. Apparently, if you're going to get booked, you have to have a Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
What?
So you have to get on there and write.
Did you make one for Egg Yolk?
I haven't yet.
No. I'll make one for you guys.
Okay.
And then you can pass the test. Yeah, right.
What do you do to make the Wikipedia page? It's like something you submit.
I've never done it.
You just get on there, and you probably have to log in, and then you create the page.
Yeah.
And you start editing it, and they have people that fact check it at some point. And
it seems like so far.
No, it's like user fact checking. So someone else could come on, and let's say, you know, you said Egg Yolk Jubilee has 2 Grammys. Someone might read that and be like, call bullshit on it.
I think when it first gets published, there's a lot of citation needed.
Right.
Parentheses on there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's going on?
I'll bet you that the Joint Barbecue has a Wikipedia page, and I don't. I'll bet. That's how I look at things.
Joel,
big-time New Orleans writer.
Look, y'all.
I will never be more popular than the Joint restaurant.
Do restaurants do Wikipedia, though? I mean, maybe something like a Mario Italian restaurant, but...
Like the chef has a Wikipedia
page.
Yeah,
like a
chef. The Joint does not.
But I bet something like Hanson Snowblizz.
But they're on Thrillist, Yelp, TripAdvisor, you know, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
I think we should make it a goal by the next time we all reconvene. Well, we all have Wikipedia pages.
Okay.
I don't want to artificially inseminate mine. I want mine to happen naturally. Although
That's
I've
so
never seen, I've se- never seen.
That is so un-American.
In the history of Wikipedia, it doesn't seem like people in New Orleans are very big on like, I'm gonna make a Wikipedia page for this person.
No,
there are a lot of people that don't have them.
Or a LinkedIn
only
page.
Chris Rose is the only person who has one in New Orleans, I think.
Did you write it? Have you been editing it a lot lately?
Well, because anyone
Chris
can
Rose
go on other people's pages and edit them.
Who else might have one?
So
Dr. John.
That.
Probably has one.
Aaron Neville probably
Aaron Neville.
One.
Oh, yeah,
that was
neither of them.
One that was
theirs.
No, they didn't make them. No, they have
Trombone Shorty has one.
Trombone Shorty. Probably.
I mean, there are publicists
Emerald
that are doing
one, clearly.
That can tell you about the Wikipedia thing.
There are probably
all
publicists
day long.
That have Wikipedia.
What would be?
Pages.
Oh, I'm sure.
What would be fun is to see who has one that's not really
Lizzie
a celebrity.
Right.
You know, that would be fun to see.
Right.
Like a list. I'm gonna put that. On.
Like Egg Yolk Jubilee, our sponsor.
Exactly.
Egg Yolk Jubilee sponsors this show, by the way. Just to let you know.
We don't run commercials. We do it.
And you also sponsor the show now. If you give us permission.
What does that entail?
You and your books and your publications sponsor the show.
Okay. That's right.
You just have to come on the show at this point.
And then
yeah, because we don't have
to write that off on my taxes, that generous donation.
There you go. I mean,
my time is worth $30 an hour.
We don't have a producer, but we do have sponsors. We do have plugs. We get to plug your stuff towards the end of the podcast. So we have sponsors and plugs. This is for real. Terra Nova.
Plugs.
Hot sausage.
Yeah.
Best in town. Thanks, Terra Nova. See? We've got sponsors.
It should be mentioned also that both of our guests are musicians as well.
Yeah.
And why, thank you.
Active musicians who play around town. Gwendolyn, you played in a band called the Green Demons, which is still somewhat together, I think.
I did indeed. I think Todd and Bill still jam. I'm not sure who they get on drums. And maybe Jason Kors still
found a new
lady
to replace you.
They did. Yeah. I'm really bad at remembering. I don't remember her name.
Well, you weren't in the band when she was in the band.
But yes, I was in the original Green Demons. We did record a CD, an album, back, I guess, in like 2009. And
I have it here.
Do you?
Yeah.
I just feel like I, as a musician, I guess, and a writer, it was pulling so much time away from my writing, and I really wanted to try and make that leap to get my work out there and get published, so I kind of married my writing instead of
I never thought of
the
it
band.
That way. You did, your success did begin after you got rid of that burden that was Green Demons.
Well, to put it that way, I mean, well,
you got
being
that job
bands,
and your
like
book
that,
came out. It, was like,
it requires so much work. It is like being in a marriage or something, you know? And I'm single. So I don't know. But I have been playing a lot of music in my bedroom with my headphones on, like a total freakazoid, and writing a bunch of songs. And I played, actually, Todd, who was in the Green Demons, we did a happy hour, like acoustic show all during August at the Circle Bar.
Huh.
And we had some guests come out, but so I was kind of working on the songs there.
How did that go?
It was okay. Some nights were like super crazy packed, and then other nights would be like one drunk lady like, your voice sounds amazing. Yeah. Actually, this woman I know was like, wow, I can't believe that's your singing voice because your regular voice is so... And she didn't finish the sentence, and I was like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it.
You get that
that's
a lot.
That's the most depressing thing in the world when you're playing at the Circle Bar, and you're like, wow, it's really empty in here.
It is.
It only takes like 8 people to banish that feeling, but
I've
had a lot.
Yeah.
I
love
like,
it.
Oh, God, it's so huge.
Just
empty in.
The amount of backhanded compliments that you get as a musician all the
exactly.
time. Where people are like, dude, I really love your guitar playing. It's just like how you're like all over the place all the time. And I'm like, huh, interesting.
You are a shredder though, man.
Shredding.
You're all over the
Thank
place.
Thank you. Appreciate
like
that.
Like from show to show. It's never the same.
It's never the same.
I love right. it.
I'm like, huh.
It's like you don't even know the songs.
I'm looking at photos on my laptop from your Circle Bar show, Halloween.
Wait, what?
Well, I don't have a producer, so.
Oh,
I'm
that
doing
was
it
a
myself.
Long time ago. I think that was in like 2009-ish. I was dressed as Angus.
Throwback
to. Or trying to.
Well, folks, we'll put these on our website, so check them out. These are some classic photos. We might even play some Green Demons on the outro today.
There you go.
You can pull that off. You guys can get a taste. I have a question for you guys about, I don't want to move off music too quickly, but I shift gears for a second. I'm curious what it's like being a writer in New Orleans and what it's like to, obviously you guys have written books, but you're also freelancers from what I can tell. Can you talk about that freelance experience on maybe both a local level as opposed to, or in contrast to a national level, what your experiences are? With that, you want to take it first, Michael?
It really depends on what the topic is. Just to make enough money to live, I will write about anything.
Right.
You know, so it's kind of like, you know, some of it you really care about a lot. Some of it you're just doing because it's a job, like making a cabinet or you know, anything like that. Someone's asking you to make something for them, and you make it. And sometimes you're designing something that has a lot of your input.
Yep.
And other times you're not. But so that being said, the different topics, I have had different amounts of hell in certain topics, like music. I don't think is very fun to write about, at least not for an opinionated person. In New Orleans, specifically in New Orleans.
Why is that?
Because it's like a big industry, and we're kind of all in it together. And especially me, because I also play music.
So you can't be critical, basically?
So they're like,
is that the idea?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of. Like, the regular rules don't apply.
Right.
That there would be, that you would, like, send your... I mean, you know, just read the stuff. You never read anything negative.
Right.
And sometimes I would write negative things. But, I like to celebrate the things that I love, and I like to be critical of... When I moved to New Orleans as a writer, and I looked around at, like, that was what I was writing about at the time, a lot about music, and that was the one thing I just was like, there's no criticism. There are no music critics in town. Luckily, New Orleans has history, so the best writers, they just focus on history and what one type of music means to another type of music and whatnot, and you don't really have to get into opinions
Sure.
or judging things. You're just telling interesting stories about history. But there's a lot of music that gets written about that doesn't have any history or any interesting story, and so I would end up having to write about a lot of that stuff, and in that case, you're just writing about your feelings about things. And
feelings.
So, you know.
All I write.
Your feelings about things?
And then memoirs.
Oh, yeah. That's true. But then in that form of journalism, they're like making you fake, like it's not just your feelings about things. And that's what I don't like. I think that kind of music that kind of music writing, you should always just be allowed to talk in first person, and so that it's like attached to the jackass who is speaking. You know what I mean? Like that's another thing that I have had a problem with, is like, you know.
I feel like if there's something of a mission that I have on this podcast is to kind of bust down the doors on some of the self-censorship thing that happens in New Orleans, because it's such a cloistered community. It's one of the things that is really odd about and unique about this town, is that there's so much culture that goes on, but it's so small. Mm-hmm. So that if you say, for instance, like, yeah, I'm not really digging that particular thing, it's almost bound to get back to that person some kind of way and cause negative feelings from that person. You're going to see them, and you're going to get some kind of chippy response.
Right.
But at the same time, it's not, you know, if you're in a big mecca like New York City or Los Angeles or Chicago or something like that, the general anonymity of geography and population density allows you to say things that are critical in a much less censored way than here, and it helps, and it makes things better.
That's true, but social media is starting to change that for anyone, anywhere, because that, I don't know, it spotlights all the hatred, vehement hatred and opinions from everyone, so while there is anonymity for everyone, there's not, because, you know, every voice is out there. Interesting.
That's true. I kind of feel about social media that it's the face of non-representative democracy. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you hear libertarians talking about the perfect world that they want to live in, you just go on Facebook and that's it. And it's just crap. You know, everybody's yelling at each other. There's no forum for moving anything forward.
No,
you know,
really,
so it just really kind of debunks the entire idea of libertarianism.
Yeah, I think
they wouldn't see it that way.
I think the insular nature, as you were talking about, of New Orleans kind of cuts through social media a little bit. Just go down to Fairgrounds any afternoon, and there's like eight dudes having a conversation about stuff that's what you're talking about, that where you can't get negative, because those are the dudes you're writing about, the musicians you're writing about.
Right.
Are there.
Yeah.
At your coffee shop.
Well, I would also say I think that New Orleans musicians just react to it differently too. I think that even if you were in a town, you can be critical without being mean, and people should not get mad at you where you should be worried about seeing them in public. That is ridiculous. I don't think
that... Has
that
happened to you?
Yeah, I have some good stories. I haven't been punched in the face yet, but I almost have. King Louie almost punched me in the face, but now we're buddies. Oh, there's never been anybody who hasn't...
That dude's from Harahan, isn't he?
Who hasn't come up to me with total anger that I haven't completely diffused them within like 5 minutes with just being sincere and, I don't know, I just think maybe people get the wrong idea, but...
Being human?
Usually when you talk to people, they're like, oh, you're not what I imagined.
I'm just not shocked at all that the one example that you came up with is a guy from Harahan.
Yeah.
You know? The guy from Harahan wants to punch you in the face.
Yeah. He was mad because I made a dig at his voice. And he came to Noise Fest.
What was it? What'd you say?
To beat... Well, I just said that I didn't like his voice in print. And... But I mean, he's clearly like a super talented dude, and if you have a lot of fans and all the support, also, what does it care? What do you care if somebody says one thing disparaging about you? You know?
Well, it says a lot about human-to-human interaction. Like you said, once you're in front of somebody, they realize you are human. I mean, look, speaking of,
and I wasn't trying to kill him or something.
And like Trumpville, Donald Trump goes to Mexico, faces the Mexican president one-on-one. And it's the most civil he's ever been in his entire life.
Yeah.
Right? Because
he's
not behind the shield of his Twitter account.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, exactly.
It's just a human interaction.
Exactly.
It's hard to call someone.
And look, if you flip the script on the writing and you were to say, capitulate to the self-censorship of that kind of criticism, then your writing's crap.
Yeah.
After that.
But that's kind of... I wanted to also say, like, Louis was totally cool. It was actually great that all happened, but we, you know, he just confronted me about it, and it was funny because I said that I didn't like his voice, and then I was like, you know, told him I'm sorry, I don't do those things to, like, hurt people's feelings, I just, blah, 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 I want to speak my mind, I want to be me and individual, and he was like, yeah, and I was like... And also, what do you care what I think anyway? Like,
and
that's
also,
what always gets me.
Well, if you're any
is that,
form of artist, if you're putting out art, you just have to be prepared for that anyway.
I guess.
I mean, even as a writer, you know, I mean,
I asked him, I was like, what do you care what I think anyway? Like, when I write the stuff, I figure people aren't going to care as much as they sometimes do. And he was like, he said, yeah, you know, one time somebody in Maximum Rock and Roll wrote that I should kill myself.
Whoa.
And he's like, and yours definitely wasn't that bad.
Wow.
And he's like, and I got over that. So, and then we just had beer, and then we like booked a show together. And
it's like two guys having a fight in the schoolyard, you know, become friends afterwards. Shortest way to.
It sounds like a John Cusack movie, actually.
Yeah.
It's like, that was a nice right hook, buddy.
Yeah.
You really got me with that one.
I was glad he didn't punch me, though. That would have been fun. I wouldn't
have been an even better story.
No.
So it's interesting because food kind of operates that same way too in New Orleans restaurants.
Right.
You know, I am by no means a critic. I used to write food reviews for St. Charles Avenue magazine, which is hilarious because it's this magazine for like old biddies who, you know, have lots of money or whatever. But that's kind of how I got my start here with the food writing situation. But with Eater, I mean, primarily I aggregate articles, generate maps, and content, that precious word, for people about where to eat, you know, good spots, spots that are hot, spots that are closing. But even in that, I always feel like just lurking over my shoulder are people ready to get upset. So I have to be, like, very careful about, you know, making fun of people, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, I do make fun of some people, Tom Fitzmaurice being the...
Oh, yeah?
Primary.
Why is that? Why?
I just think he's, I don't know, he's very, I don't know, he's like old and crotchety. But
don't you feel like there's a lot of that going on in New Orleans? Like, I feel like there's an umbrella of production quality that permeates a lot of different things in New Orleans, that the rule book was written by Peggy Scott Laborde.
I love Peggy Scott Laborde.
I mean, I just feel that way about a lot of things. Like, all the PBS documentaries have this patina, you know, yes. And it's all like.
Ugh. It is really interesting. It's interesting, kind of having to exist in that world, going to these events and stuff with all those people. It's very interesting because a lot of them have like, you know, there's like weird little issues. Like, I don't like this person. I don't like this person. You're watching these like people who are in their like 50s and 60s have all these beefs with like all these other people. It's hysterical. But I went to this wine dinner at Brennan's, I guess, a couple weeks ago. Ralph Brennan was, like, unveiling his wine cellar. And I got sat at this table of, like, all these, like, big food writers or whatever. I'm sitting next to John Mariani, who's, like, a famous food writer, and across from Tom Fitzmaurice. And they both start talking about these novels that they're working on. Apparently, Tom Fitzmaurice is working on a novel about two nuns.
Oh, really?
One of which I shouldn't give away. I shouldn't give away the plot.
That's great. Awesome.
But no, I was just like, this is blowing my mind. He has no. He doesn't know who I am. But like on Eater, I'll call him T Fitz. I've shortened his name, and you know, he writes funny reviews. Like he always uses these really esoteric words, like foodstuffs. He talks about he's always upset when places are too noisy and just any sort of like modern trends he gets kind of irritated with, and it's like listening to, you know,
it's like fuck Kellen Beats.
Yeah, it's like listening to some crotchety uncle like bitch about restaurants, and it's really funny to recap it.
Tracy and I were talking about how a lot of the Eater foodie events are like the whitest events in the city. You know, it's a really integrated city. And like New Orleans has a way of like creating some of the whitest events that you've ever fucking seen in your life.
We went to the, about 2 months ago, we went to the Gambit Sous Chef.
Yes.
Challenge.
Oh, I didn't go to that. Was it good?
The food was excellent. Cool. One of our friends was one of the participants. Mm-hmm. So contestants. So that's the reason we went to support him. Mm-hmm. Meatball. Shout out to Meatball. From formerly of Dick and Jenny's, no longer, unfortunately. But man, it was the whitest room I've ever been in my entire effing life. And I used to go to Birmingham as a child to visit my grandparents. You know, I was like hanging out in their church.
There's only
this
one
still
event.
The whitest room I've ever been in.
I know.
Oh, I know what you're gonna say.
The LPO event in the park, Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra in City Park. Is the
when everyone brings like tables like this, like a coffee table, and sets up their wine, and you're like, did you haul in movers to move this stuff?
And look, laundry? I mean, you can go to these events and have a perfectly good time, but it's just kind of shocking when you get there. You know, it's like, you got to be kidding me. How is it even possible to round up as many people that are white in this town?
That's true.
And white linen and art for art's sake, but that's actually not as bad. But
yeah. And there's Dirty Linen Night now, too, right? Isn't that what it's called?
I guess. That's the one on Royal? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't have any of these.
I haven't gone to any of them in a while.
And so what projects are you guys working on now?
This is like the first year that I've kind of taken off. I have a novel I'm working on, but I seriously mostly have just been fishing. And I've been paying for it financially. Yeah, freelancing is like all about how much if you get paid for all the energy that you put into it, you know. And so I've been getting paid less because I've been putting less energy into it this year. But it's also like, you know, you're like collecting ideas and you have to have the ideas or you can't get the work. You know, you have to have a good subject and last year especially I did a bunch of things that were like really rare subjects, or I was really lucky to be given something that I got in a good magazine, and I like used up a ton of them last year, and this year I've just been like fishing and doing content.
Was that the stuff totally on Vice that you were doing last year?
I still do like a thing on Vice like maybe every couple months.
Yeah. I was reading about the Slavery Museum, and I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, that was excellent subject.
Yeah.
You know, I write so my writing is so like tied to New Orleans and Louisiana that it really has to be the right thing to be able to get it published in a national magazine or the Guardian International. I mean, Vice and the Guardian, I guess now are like worldwide. But
do you primarily pitch, or do you have people approaching you?
No, you know, I actually, that's another reason why I kind of calmed down a little bit this year, is because after that Katrina 10th anniversary, I just worked so hard and done so many things, and I always did think there would come a time when, like, you just sit back and let the phone ring, or you're just, like, getting emails instead of trying to figure out an idea and then trying to figure out how to get in touch with an editor about it and talking them into it. And, like, that's a whole other job that probably takes up more time than the writing does. Mm. So then when the Katrina 10th anniversary happened was the first time when people started writing to me and saying, can you get me in contact with Chris Rose? Now, that actually happened to me a bunch, too.
can you describe what it was that you wrote?
Not necessarily
about Chris Rose in particular, but, like, describe the Katrina 10th anniversary thing. Like, what?
Oh, people were writing to me and you know, they wanted me to write New Orleans stories. One of the things I did a thing for Vice where I, like, went back and talked to some of the prisoners who were left behind in the jail and when it was flooding, you know.
Right, yeah. Right.
There were some mm-hmm. oral histories, you know, that were taken of those guys right after it happened and stuff, and the years after. But, you know, I just went back and found some of them all these years later and told that story, which can't be told enough times, even though it was kind of repetitive to, you know. When they wrote to me about it, I'm like, oh, everybody knows that story, but everybody doesn't know that story, and that's the craziest that, you know what I'm talking about.
Sure, right? Yeah, no, that they were...
Everybody just left them there.
People, yeah, cells. Just left in the jail cells as it was crazy. Flooding.
I can't believe they haven't made a horror movie about that yet.
Right, right.
That's like a perfect horror movie. Sure. It's like exact, oh, it's yeah, just a horror movie.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I know, I've thought about that. But the...
Copyright Tom Fitzmaurice. Yeah.
And then The Guardian had me write about fishermen and shrimpers and crabbers and, like, how they're doing 10 years after Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of funny because they're really, it didn't, they had the oil spill in between. So mm-hmm. if you start talking about Katrina, all those guys are like,
yeah.
Right.
That was some of the best fishing. You know, some of them will tell you, like, that year and I, you know, I got out there, I caught more fish. But I mean, a lot of people lost their boats and that was a big thing, like getting your boat back in the water. But as soon as you got your boat back in the water, it was on.
It was on, right.
But not like the oil spill where it's like still, you know.
Right, right.
Still bad things happening from that. But yeah, so, and they were giving me all these really great stories and and then after the Korean 10th anniversary was gone, it just dried up,
right.
Yeah. And the stories, you know, they were all like good stories, but yeah, and you always think people are going to be like reaching out to you, but with email, and it's so easy to write to editors, and there's so many people writing, and you really have to be competitive.
You have to hustle.
You really do. And it's like, you know.
Exhausting.
It really is. And this is the first year when I'm just like, after going through that Katrina thing, and then it still didn't like cause any kind of momentum where I had to work less. I just kind of was like, and I got that boat right
you're
at
like,
the same time.
I'm going fishing.
And I'm like, I'm just going to get my food this
you
way.
You like literally hung up the sign.
Yeah.
Going fishing.
Yeah. But that's been great. And then I also, you know, try to write about that. I've like written a lot about, I'm learning more about the coast, and especially as the years come up and go by, there's going to be coastal reporting is going to be like a huge,
yeah,
like Vice is going to have a coastal mm-hmm. reporting.
Sure.
I've talked to them about it now, and they're like, oh no, you know,
it's going to happen.
It's going to happen.
Of course,
within 10 years, they're going to have that.
I mean, look at what's happening in Florida
every
right
paper.
Now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's going to be happening here too.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, but look, they might have forgotten about us after 10th year anniversary, but at least Mark Wahlberg is making the Deepwater Horizon movie.
He's here in town.
So at least that's happening.
Yeah.
We got that going for us. Obviously, I'm joking.
And I'll tell you something. I read a review of it And just from a filmic standpoint, they were saying that it was pretty good.
Really?
Yeah. I know it seems.
That kind of makes me sad.
It seems ridiculous mind, because I thought that the poster was one of the most ridiculous things I've ever seen. Because Mark Wahlberg is one of the most ridiculous human beings that's ever been in my mind.
Yeah.
And
Boogie Nights.
He's got
awesome.
Oil all. Boogie Nights was great. I mean, but that's Paul Thomas Anderson. You know,
that's a prosthetic. Transcendent. That was a prosthetic, by the way. That wasn't a real penis.
Right.
Well, they picked him. They gave him.
Slow our roll a little bit on the Mark Wahlberg craze.
But he's got oil all over his face. And it was just,
of course he does.
I had to take a photo of it when I was leaving this oil other movie that I went to see because I just thought it's a ridiculous image, you know what I mean? Yeah. And the fact that movie is, it probably premiered here, you know?
I think it was last night.
It was last night,
Josh,
right, of course.
My photographer for Eater also takes photos of like everything. He's like everywhere. But he had one up on Instagram of Mark Wahlberg and one of Mark Wahlberg with Kate Hudson. And Kate Hudson is actually taller than Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
According to this photo.
All the male actors are fairly, all the like big male actors are really short. From what
And every scene of her in the preview is,
I have to watch it now.
You got to see the preview. Every scene of her is at home
on the phone.
On the phone. Which every fucking scene, that's what she gets to do in the movie.
Which describes half of the female parts in Hollywood right now.
Yeah,
being on the phone.
Fucking ridiculous, man. I know.
It is ridiculous. Like, what's Connie Britt, or was that her name? Who's in the Connie Britt, who used to be on Friday Night Lights and films and a television show here. Every movie she's in, she's just on the phone. Or she's in the stands cheering her husband football coach.
Right.
That's it.
That would be a great.
That's all she does.
Right.
It'd be a great mashup. Yeah, all the women on phones. You know, they're supposed to be like the moral fiber of the movie or whatever, you know, or the moral compass, I should say. Just on the phone.
It's
always a landline. And
it's probably a fiber.
And what are they doing?
Smaller.
The conversation is always the same. How are you doing?
Right.
Horrible.
Is there anything I can do?
Shit just blew up. What can I do? Nothing.
This is literally the
promise
plot
me
of the movie. What's going on?
No, but then in the third act, the phone is, you have my permission to carry forward. Because the first two acts are like, no, you have to come home. This is too dangerous.
Right.
Third act is, you save those people.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so she gives permission.
Don't you concern yourself with me or the baby.
To our hero.
Right. She comforts the sad 3-year-old kid.
Exactly.
Kids are always 3, by the way.
Yeah, because
they're always around 3 years old.
Because you don't want speaking parts. Right. But you also don't want a wailing baby.
It's because if they, if they're any logistics younger, they're actually not going to give a shit that you die.
Right.
Your child is
that's
not
right
going to care at all that you die if they're not at least like 3.
3. That's right around
I
the time.
I think actually
they
that
I'd
if
five.
I died, I know, I was going to say if I died any time before like this year, I think my kids would have been like, just got over it. Maybe later in their life they would feel that something was missing, but they wouldn't be
after
like,
therapy.
Oh, God, I missed that guy. Yeah.
I was watching a 9/11
they wouldn't even remember
special
it
or whatever, and they had different folks who lost people. But two of them were sisters, and one was 3, and the other one was not yet born, right? And the one that was not yet born was really having a hard time, like, mustering up, like, emotion about
right,
having
true
lost
it's
her
true
father. He's
yeah
like, what? I mean,
when
I
you're
saw
like
some
5,
photos
you don't remember things that happened when you were 4, and then you're 6, and then you don't remember the things that happened to you when you were 5.
Right.
You know, later on, you might have some perspective where you're like, oh, I remember these things that happened to me when I was 6. But, like, I quiz Cleo all the time because I'm just interested in the way her memory and mind works.
Sure.
And it'll be like, really? You don't remember that at all? You remember this song? No, I don't remember it because you used to sing every word of it for like 2 weeks on end where you were driving us crazy. And now you don't, you just don't think
nope
you've ever heard it before.
Yep.
She's like, Dad,
exactly.
I heard you and Mom talking. Isn't that just called blacked out?
Yeah.
Is that all that is?
Yeah, long-term memory she's doesn't kick out in until, I don't
right
know, you're like 4, something
right
like that. Yeah. It's kind of kooky.
But
I heard that I read that the editing was somehow completely random in the action sequences in this movie. It's Peter Berg directed it, right?
Oh, okay, I like him.
And except for that movie Battleship that he did, which was fucking terrible. I don't know if you saw that or not.
Is that the one with Rihanna? Is she in it?
Yes.
Is she based on the board game?
Yeah, it's based on the. I know it's.
Dude, I mean, horrible. I think he's coming out with Operation next.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. He's been signed on by Hasbro.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like, anyway, it's supposed to be really frenetic, and you can't. This one reviewer I read said you can't make hide nor hair of what's the glue that holds the action together because everything is so chaotic, and. But at the same time, they're like, it hangs together, you know, pushes the narrative
forward.
Well,
it's good that they're keeping it in the news.
But what's the narrative anyway? You know, it's like, this shit blows up, everything's falling down,
there's fire, people are dying. Is anybody to blame in the movie,
and
you know?
That's the big question.
Yeah.
That's what I would like to do.
John Malkovich is the guy that's to blame.
Oh, it's
perfect.
Just a guy.
Right.
Don't blame BP. It was just some one faulty guy.
He's the BP guy that's there to make sure that Transocean is staying on time. So in other words, they really do go after BP 100%.
Right.
I mean, if you read the real story of what happened, there's a lot of shared responsibility across the board. You know, there are two companies trying to maximize profit and blah blah blah. Transocean is by no means like some tiny company,
right?
You know, it's like
that name is so
operator.
Evil sounding.
It really is, right? Exactly. And but they lay the blame squarely on BP, and he's the BP representative, and he's there to push whoever the other actor is. It's Kurt Russell, right? So they put Kurt Russell in the good guy role.
Right.
He's probably got a mustache.
Wear an eye patch.
Right. I gotta say, I listened to a Kurt Russell interview recently, and it was very entertaining. You know, and anyway, he talked about working on the thing, and there's a host of Kurt Russell movies that I find great.
Well, dude, Escape from New York.
All the John Carpenter movies that he made are fucking like the bomb.
Escape from New York, man, come on.
Escape from New York is fucking great.
It's brilliant, ahead of its time.
Yeah. The Thing, man, is. I mean, for me, The Thing is transcendent.
It's really good.
Yeah. You like that movie?
Yeah. I like They Live as well.
Oh, my God, man. Come on.
I mean, I really like John Carpenter.
Yeah. Yeah. He's just.
But I was listening to him on a podcast with Bret Easton Ellis, and he started to venture into this weird, like, misogynistic tone when talking about, like, women in movies.
How so?
And, like,
example?
I can't really remember.
You would never,
like,
know that from his movies.
Well, exactly. Something about, like, you know, uppity women complaining that they don't get good parts or something. And he was like, these women. It was like one of those situations. But, I mean, Bret Easton Ellis usually eggs people on when it comes to that sort of thing because he's anti-snowflake PC people, so...
Right.
But I really love John Carpenter. I love his music as well. I think it's really cool that he's like still playing with like his son and like creating this music and touring. I mean.
Oh, is he? What?
Yeah. I had no idea about that.
Yeah.
For real?
And actually, go see John Carpenter play in Houston with Aphex Twin and Bjork, and like if there's some festival and Run the Jewels and.
Well, I don't even know who Aphex Twin is.
Oh man,
you know,
that's music.
I have no idea, and all I can tell you is this: is that it's been all over Facebook in the news feed, and John Carpenter is going to be there, and that's not in the fucking news feed. What's going on with that? Yeah.
Well, you know, Aphex Twin is more well known as a musician. I actually didn't know that John Carpenter was a musician.
Carpenter scored all of his early films.
I didn't know that.
And he continues to play. And apparently his son is like really into it as well. And they have like all of these tracks that they record.
Yeah, that festival.
And are
some
off
festival
of.
In Houston. It looks
some,
like
what is
the
festival called? Do you know?
I don't remember. But Bjork.
Something weird happened the other day. Somebody was posting about what do you think. It was one of these Facebook posts about. What do you think is the best action scene in movies? And one of the things that came to my mind was like, I think the dog chase scene at the beginning of The Thing is one of the coolest scenes that's ever been filmed in a horror movie. Because
it's Kurt Russell.
Well, I mean, it's they're
he was
in
the dog. Yes,
they're in Antarctica,
right?
And this helicopter appears like way off in the distance. You have no idea what's going on, and then suddenly there's a dog. Running through the snow, and there's these strange men with kind of sunglasses, visor things on, and they're shooting at the dog, and they're hell bent on killing this one dog, and you have no understand. You don't know why.
Yeah.
And you're just like, what is going on? And it's like right from the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
And that
they really did utilize the dogs well, because then there's the other scene where the dogs are like pinned up and one of them has the thing inside of it and they're acting all weird, you know.
That's right.
That.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot of like good animal use in that.
It's true. And I'll tell you what happened is that I thought that he did the score for The Thing also. And I was rewatching that scene on YouTube, and it was Morricone that did the score for that movie.
That's amazing. I didn't realize that.
So kind of, I know. It's really, but he used a lot of synth because he knew that,
Love that synth.
The synth.
Except for when my upstairs neighbor is practicing his at 2 in the morning.
They're popular now.
How do we get off on that, by the way?
Speaking of the synth, the score for The Nick
is
fantastic. You guys watch that show, The Nick?
No.
We'll just move on, but the score is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a Steven Soderbergh directed Cinemax series about the
set 1901 Manhattan.
Okay, I've seen a few episodes was still with Clive.
But they got bought by
Clive Owen. Yeah,
okay. So now
they're
doing good programming.
And it was like very brutal to watch.
It's brutal to watch. It's excellently rendered. It didn't get enough recognition for the two seasons that I think that it's only going to be around.
The music is fantastic.
The music is
and
fantastic.
It's like synth electronic.
That Netflix viral show Stranger Things also pulled out the
sort of
John Carpenter. I know Michael doesn't like it, but
you didn't like it.
The music is actually
I was thinking of it when you were just describing about how you don't know what's going on, and I love stuff like that where it takes a long time to figure out what's going on. And so I started watching Stranger Things, and it was like that, but it just didn't.
Now the showrunners are going to get back to you and they're going to be angry.
What did you say earlier? I'm trying to think of the quote that you said earlier.
Jackass who's...
What is it, jackass who...
Oh, I always think of...
You said something before, and we'll put it on the website, folks, but it should be the name. If you ever do a collection of essays of your critical work, that should be...
One jackass's opinion.
Yeah.
I feel like your work might be headed for the coastal stuff, though. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Now that
this year I wrote
fishing.
A lot about that. Kind of, relatively a lot. Those two things were brought for...
Nice segue, by the way.
Why, thank you.
For that you have one article in that magazine, too, that Louisiana Cultural Vistas.
Mm-hmm. I love that magazine.
Thing from the LEH that's kind of... Brian Boyles is behind the wheel now, and he's kind of bringing it up. It's kind of like Oxford American. You ever seen it?
No.
Morgana, people are always like, where do you get that? And Morgana joked, she said, the only place you can get it is in the lobby at the mayor's office.
Right. I believe it.
But it's like a really super nice magazine, and it doesn't really get out as much. You do have to like go into one of the city buildings almost to get it. I don't see it anymore.
It's a nice
magazine.
But
it's really nice, and they pay really well.
It's like
they have
three
good
steps below like getting published on airplanes, right?
Except for, you know, nothing's below if you get paid well. Those airplane magazines.
Have you guys ever tried that?
Every time I'm on the airplane, I flip through that thing thinking, as soon as I get home, I need to send some emails.
I was going to ask you if you guys tried to do that.
Yeah, but you get a lot of money that way. I've done stuff like that for sure. Tons of stuff like that.
I was in a creative writing program at Northern Arizona University. And the basic thing that I took away was it was like, you got to try, and if you're going to work on a novel, get published on the airplanes. I was like, that's kind of what I attempted to do.
When I also was in a creative writing program, but took it a step further and got an MFA, which is...
Congratulations.
I don't know if I would recommend it for everyone or anyone. But when I came out of there, I was publishing like short stories and stuff in literary magazines that nobody reads. I mean, I think they're read by agents and other writers
really
who
is
are
just
trying
agents,
to get
right.
published. But I feel like it did help. I mean, agents would contact me, and it kept me going and wanting to write. But I don't know. At that kind, but I feel like getting into more of like the mainstream magazines. Airplane type magazines, so I've never been in one, but stuff that you know the general population would read
is more.
I feel like it's a little bit more of a validation that you're doing something okay than you
know
like
that.
A, literary magazine. I don't know.
Well, I was just thinking there might be a coastal story for it could be interesting for a magazine. That's why I even thought about it.
Sure. Mm-hmm. They don't, you know, a lot of those stories are like warning people that the apocalypse is coming. So I don't know how much travel magazines really wouldn't be the.
But it's interesting to explore it, like
it's gone.
The Louisiana cultural vistas. Sure, sure, yeah.
I don't think they're going that route, though. They don't want to bum people out.
But I think like what we did, because you also spoke with Oysterman for Louisiana Cultural Vistas, right? Mm-hmm. So talking to people who are directly affected by that is the way to tell the story. I mean, obviously, not everybody wants these sort of, you know, I'm a snarky blogger person telling you why the world is ending because the coast is gone. Yeah, you know, they. I feel like when you find people who have stories to tell, that is the best way to get across news.
I feel somewhat like people are still half talking about it as though it's not kind of happening,
right?
Even though it's happening.
I think some on the figure something out here.
If you're on the vanguard of the Gulf of Mexico in the southernmost part of Louisiana, it is happening.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
Climate change and the effects of climate change and other factors that have deteriorated the coastline, not the least of which are levees and other intrusions by the petroleum industry, have deteriorated the land to such an extent that entire communities are going to be moved. It's not just something that people are speculating about.
Right.
Money has been allocated to move these communities, to plan the moving, the inevitable relocation of
these
communities.
There's also been, though, a lot of money.
Yeah. It is terrible, but it's
allocated
happening. But people are still talking about it like it's not.
Like it's in the future.
People like it's way off
somewhere.
Mm-hmm. It's like it's happening. You know?
Well, I think part of it is that there's also like a ton of money, and some of it is BP money that's allocated to bring those things back, which, you know,
they're
if
not
you start talking to
back.
People, no, I know, but they're still like, it's still a thing that they're going to supposedly try to do. You know, like, I think that is part of the reason why people are talking about it like it's not happening all the way, because they're like, oh, well, this is starting to happen, but they have all this money and they're going to rebuild this
think that,
island
that
disappeared. Mm-hmm. You know, no, I don't think they're going to.
Because they think that coastal reclamation is going to be 100% successful, that there's actually going to be some reclamation to a degree where the land will be restored in a way that it existed in the past. It's just simply not going to happen.
No,
that way. It's not going to happen that way,
right?
At all.
I didn't get it published, but I wrote the story recently that I actually just got really into the subject, and so started calling tons and tons of scientists and stuff about it. But I wrote about Cat Island, which there's like a big Cat Island in Mississippi, but then there's a smaller one in Louisiana that's that was a pelican rookery, and it was like 4 acres or something, pretty small mangrove trees, which is not something you see everywhere in Louisiana, mangrove trees.
But you're starting to see them more and more.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, they're good. They hold land together. You know, they're like roots are just like hands. And so if you can keep them alive, you can have an island just from that. And Cat Island, that's really what it was. And when BP hit, you know, that killed all those things, and they just let go of the, they just, you know, let the mangroves let go of the island, and so
it's just
gone. The whole island disappeared in the last 10 years.
Sure.
And and I got, while I was researching it, I got this like list of like 30 islands that had happened to in the last like 100 years. And Barataria Bay is sinking. That's part of the, you know, climate change. But they sent me all these pictures of these like oil rigs, like that they aren't in use anymore, and they're like 10 feet under the water, just naturally 10 feet under the water from when they were built,
right?
Because the bay has sunk, you know,
right?
Yeah.
The waters have come up and the bay has sunk simultaneously, like
but they have all this money and they're going to rebuild Cat Island, and you know, there are people who are like, yeah, we should rebuild anything that was out there. It's worth doing. And then there are people who are just like, that is the most ridiculous thing to try to do, you know, try to rebuild something that's gone. You should build spend all that money on what's still there and that you can protect from disappearing instead of trying to build the St. Rock Market out there in the...
Right.
The St. Rock Market version of Cat Island.
You know, all the controversy about that really did die down. It seems like you never hear like people. I mean, I don't ever hear people anymore saying horrible things about St. Rock Market. It was just in those first few months.
I mean, that's what happens with everything. There's a brouhaha. And then, you know, and then it dies down.
Then people get used to it.
And a lot of it is because, like, most people are like, meh, you know?
Yeah.
All right, healing center.
Right, the healing center, that was supposed to be the great, horrible thing that was going to happen to
you. I mean, it's still so crazy that down there is no grocery store. It just blows my mind.
They're saving
whatever that litigation is with
the... Did you see my Gambit article?
I didn't. I'm sorry, I missed that.
I wrote a Gambit article about when all that St. Rock Market thing was happening. Because it was pretty funny because people would be
there
like...
There is a grocery store.
Well, people would be like, I can't believe they put that St. Rock Market there. And say, well, what do you
There's
think
should
be there?
There's two grocery stores.
What do you think should be there instead? There should be a grocery store that is specifically for the income of the people in this neighborhood. Where they have fresh...
What the fuck does that mean?
Or where they have fresh produce at an affordable price for the people in this neighborhood, blah, blah, blah. And they pretty much go on to just describe Save-A-Lot. To a T, you know, and right. You're like, it's three blocks from
right
the
over
Rock
there,
Market. You're describing exactly what is over there, you know, and then they're like, oh well, that doesn't have coconut milk.
If you went to the fucking manager and you said,
yeah. Well, I did an article about that, and I went to the manager.
They
and he
will
also
buy it
was
for
like,
you.
Yeah, anything you want. The one thing about
like
them,
this guy goes to Canseco's, and there's like 10 items at Canseco's now because Joel's like, hey, man, if you buy it, you know. I'll,
right.
The guy's like, I'll buy it.
That's totally what he said, too. And they have their meat is like fresh. It's not frozen. Like Walmart has like a frozen
it's
where
like
they bring
bodega,
in frozen meat.
Right?
It's a bodega.
But the one thing about them is that they're
But it's a full
one of their
supermarket.
Yeah. It's a good supermarket, I think.
It just doesn't have like... all that organic shit.
And then also people are like, well, they don't have the name brand foods, canned foods or whatever that I like.
Amy's.
Actually, we buy
these from a company where
it's the same exact food and they put different labels on all the same food. And you can buy the like generic labels and it's the same food as...
Of course, because...
You know?
Yeah, because people don't understand...
Right.
That,
it's like it all comes from the same company.
Yeah, there's one place where this is getting made, right?
You know,
and
the
there's
expensive version of the same thing.
From 4 to 7 during the day, one label is being put on the can. You know, and from 11 to 4, it's another label.
I'm not saying. I mean, I definitely would not say that Save-A-Lot is the best grocery store, and that everybody should just settle for Save-A-Lot, but. It was kind of, you know.
See, if this article was on Eater, the headline would have been Save-A-Lot needs to add coconut milk. And you get like a bazillion people.
Must add coconut milk.
Must add.
Circle Foods opened.
Right.
Also. Right. And I guess people say, well,
that's supposedly not enough.
It's not my neighborhood.
Right.
It's like it's right the fuck there for crying out loud. What are you talking
about?
I do
think that they should have not used the name St. Rock Market. I think that actually could be almost like problem solved.
Really?
Yeah. I think that was really the thing that made everybody so mad. Is you don't
call, I could see that, yeah.
You don't call it the same thing when it was just called that a few years ago and it was totally different. You know what I mean? That really to me is the thing that set everybody off. Of course, there was the whole thing about ignoring the neighborhood's needs and what they said and blah blah blah, but I just think it's like inflamed it way more to be like, here's your new version of St. Rock Market. This is what New Orleans is going to be like from now on. We're going to call it the same thing, but it's going to be totally different.
They should have just gone meta with the name and called it Market Market.
Yeah, the Market Market.
You know, like Bar Bar. Like they got those cropping up everywhere now.
Or just anything else. But to use the old name and call it something new, I just think that really made people more mad than they would have otherwise.
It's just so interesting that people get mad.
Well, it's also like
the NIMBYs.
In all the different neighborhoods in the city, there's something about this area between Esplanade, Poland, the river, and St. Claude Avenue that it's like anything that happens down here is something that's worth talking about because it's just happening. And for me, I mean, as the owner of Lost Love Lounge, it just always seemed everybody was always soliciting my opinion about this stuff. And I was like, I really don't care. I don't care that much.
I guess it's kind of seen as like the gentrification microcosm. You know, like, let's look at this as the bubble for everything that's happening in American cities. You can kind of do that with it.
I think there's some merit to that. But that neighborhood has been on that trajectory for 20 to 25 years, you know. And so I think the more significant incursions where you can see that there are really damaging effects in terms of housing and people being displaced are kind of sort of happening in other areas, you know, like Gentilly right here. You know, if you just go down the street that way, you can get a feel for that kind of stuff happening, you know. I mean, even here, just up the street now, there's a new bar on the left-hand side called the Jockey Pub is what it's called. And, you know.
How's that?
I haven't been yet, but, you know, I went over there and there was like, you know, a couple of hipsters making out, you know, like,
yes,
always a good sign
in front of it. And I was like, huh,
success.
Do they have frozen cocktails inside?
Gosh, exactly.
You know, making out, hipsters making out outside equals frozen cocktails inside.
Yeah,
that's right.
Look, for that, you just got to go to Piro's over here. Yeah. Right. Yeah, you just hit that joint. They got the daiquiris.
That place is kind of, that place seems kind of good.
The food's great.
Know. Yeah.
It's fantastic. They I think they live that, upstairs and. Yeah. But I don't think their plan like is according. I don't think they're. It's going according to their business plan. I think.
Really?
Well, I just think that they didn't expect necessarily to attract mostly, you know, an old black man clientele.
Yeah.
I don't think that was their plan.
You know? But that's what makes it fit. Kind of fit in is it totally. Seems like it could be like that still. I didn't walk in there and think,
whoa, what is this?
But then that's, I was like, oh, this looks. Like
this
it's
makes
been
sense.
Here a long
well, and then
time.
You see the frozen shit. Twirling around, and you're like, fucking yeah, I'm home.
So I kind of feel like that about this whole Bayou Road. Folks, we're talking about this area in New Orleans that's like just off Broad Street, if you want to Google it, Broad and Esplanade Avenue.
District.
And I'm sorry, what are they? Have they thought up a new name for that?
I always think of it as the Rasta District.
Well, they got
the Caribbean
Rasta Club.
District. Okay, good. They got the Caribbean,
Caribbean Club.
Right. Yeah.
I was just like,
they used to have the incense sellers.
If any place in New Orleans should, if New Orleans should look like anything going into the future in terms of integrating all the different cultural aspects, including things that are new and coming into this neighborhood, because they have like the Domino Sound place, you know, it's kind of hipster record store and stuff like that. It should look like that.
Yeah.
Over there, you know, like McCarty's Chicken.
They got the
is
Jamaican,
there.
They got the jerk restaurant.
Right. There, yeah. Exactly. It's a great little.
And they got the dudes on the neutral ground selling fruit every day.
Oh, and they got the hippie, the hippie,
teenagers.
The hippie organic restaurant over there too.
They got that. You know,
that's I call it the hippie organic restaurant.
Yes, so it's everything.
What is the name of that place?
What are you talking about? You're not talking about Pagoda.
Pagoda, yeah, right.
Oh,
exactly.
Is it hippie organic?
I don't know.
I almost
that's
can't.
That's Abram and his wife, yes.
I can't generally go there.
Not Abram times. Doesn't have anything to do with that, actually. His wife, Shauna, does that restaurant.
Oh,
Abram's
wife.
I mean, here's what here's how like, intolerant I am about human beings, man. I've gone over there 3 times to grab breakfast and started
to walk
up.
Can I say that I love that place, by the way?
And I just turned around.
Was it just overrun with people?
What place?
The place you guys are talking about, the
Pagoda.
I'm just like, I can't deal. Because it's usually the morning and I'm hungover or something. Mm-hmm. But it's just like, I just can't deal with these hipster white people. Like, I just can't. I can't have the social interaction right now.
Yeah.
I'd rather go talk to somebody else besides
that's like
these
everyone who stands in line for brunch. And yet they continue to stand. They continue to stand in line
that's
for brunch.
Right. That's right.
They're
that's
all
my,
the same thing.
That's my no-fly zone list. I don't stand in line for brunch. Ever.
Never.
In
never.
Algiers,
yeah,
we just
never.
Go to
that's
IHOP.
Broken up. That's broken
yeah,
up
what's going on over in Algiers, man, eating-wise these days?
Oh, I went to Algiers Fest, which was a festival that was giving credit to the police. That was a good thing that I went to on Saturday. It was a whole festival giving big ups to the cops because the cops in New Orleans do such a great job. I only stuck around for Tank and the Bangers. They had a lot of good music there, actually. We live next to Federal City, and Federal City is kind of like our personal private playground. And they have the Ochsner Center. They just changed the YMCA to the Ochsner Gym. And they put in this incredible pool with like a kid's water park.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's
awesome.
Cool.
And Linda Hamilton from The Terminator moved near us.
You said that.
And
the
so
other
she
night.
Hangs out.
How's her biceps?
She looks good.
Hey guys, this
she looks like a person.
I'm sorry, but this program's got a I just got to interrupt real quick. It's got a time limit on it, and we've got less than 30 seconds. I'm glad I swiped through on now. Just for you know, we do multiple. If you guys parts.
Shout out to Linda Hamilton.
I actually have to get back to work. How long? Much longer?
Let's say goodbye, and then
How much time you got?
We'll do 20 minutes.
Yeah, we got to say goodbye, guys. We'll be back.
Goodlifebabe.com.
Okay, bye.